The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 14th of January 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Monocle Studio here in Zurich. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up on today's program:
what is required is going to be a much more extensive retrospective epidemiologic study to look at those first cases and clusters in Wuhan and to fully understand the links between those cases.
A World Health Organization team has finally arrived in Wuhan to investigate the origins of the COVID-19 virus, but how likely is China to cooperate? Also ahead.
The ayes are 232, the nays are 197. The resolution is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Donald Trump becomes the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice. We'll ask whether it could spell the end of his political career. Plus, we'll also get an update on skirting the COVID situation here in Switzerland, and we'll delve into the world of luxury too. All that right here in The Briefing with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, good afternoon from a very, very snowy Zurich. The World Health Organization team has arrived in the Chinese city of Wuhan to start its investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. The virus was first detected in the city in late 2019, but Chinese authorities have so far resisted attempts to allow the WHO to carry out forensic research. Well, Monocle's Asia editor James Chambers joins me on the line from Hong Kong now. James, good afternoon. It's interesting. We've been looking at some of the images. This was, of course, an arrival which was broadcast on some Chinese state outlets. People in spacesuits greeting these people who've arrived from the WHO in Geneva. Just maybe give us a little bit of background. There's been so much to-ing and fro-ing, given something which, of course, has dominated the global news agenda, has dominated billions of lives. Why the obstruction? You know, 1 year on, that this investigation team, a very small one, we might add, has finally been able to gain access to Wuhan.
Yeah, so the team from the WHO arrived today, and they'll be entering a 2-week quarantine in China. So it's not like they'll be able to begin their field research right away. They're saying they're going to start their work remotely, but that'll be a 2-week. Wait until they're allowed actually out and allowed to see the market where this all happened or where this all started. But two of the members didn't even make it because they failed an antibodies test in Singapore. So they'll have to catch up with the rest of the team, in time when they pass those tests. But as you said, this has had a bit of a false start last week because some of the members were already on their way when the trip was held up. We don't quite know why that was, but it's good to see that they're in the country now, and they're going to start their investigations. But as you mentioned, this has been going on for months. It was mid last year when the WHO decided they needed to send a team to Wuhan to investigate the origins of the coronavirus. And there's been a lot of back and forth between Geneva and Beijing since then. Everyone's been scratching their heads about why it's taken so long to get to this point. But it is very good news for the whole world that it's finally going to get underway.
But James, if you look at this from almost any angle, it just looks uncooperative. The fact that this is such an important issue on every level globally, that again, also you would think, aside from moving this quickly, there was issues with visas last week. I mean, why is China being so obstructive?
I guess there's two parts to this, to the coronavirus. The early work that the WHO and China did was to try and figure out, what the heck was going on, to try and put a name on this flu-like virus that emerged in Wuhan at the end of 2019. And the second part is obviously figuring out how it happened, where it came from. Now, the second part has become very, very political. Obviously, a lot of the world is looking at China to provide some answers, but China has been, over the last year, trying to change the narrative slightly and raise questions about where the coronavirus actually originated. There have been a lot of stories about cases being found in Paris in late 2019, or the west coast of the US or Italy, and a lot of Chinese politicians and Chinese people have kind of latched onto this and are trying to be kind of create this alternative story that perhaps the virus didn't come from China after all. So the problem now is, has China essentially backed itself into a corner? You have some very, very senior Chinese politicians saying that, casting doubt on whether the virus originated in China. And so you have to raise question marks about whether they do want the WHO team to establish the fact that it might have started in this wet market in Wuhan.
James Chambers, our bureau chief in Hong Kong, thank you very much for that. We're going to stay on the story, though. I'm joined by Dr. Chris Smith. He's Monocle's health and science correspondent. He's in Cambridge. Chris, good afternoon. And from your side, when you look at this, and I go back to these images that I saw this morning with this arrival, just the positioning of it, of course, of these investigators, people are coming to assess the situation in Wuhan, the type of greeting that they were given, and albeit a very, very late one. How do you read this?
I don't think China has a very strong track record in this area, if I'm honest with you. They're really behaving true to form. And in the previous SARS outbreak in 2002 to 2003, they sat on very important data and did not disclose it for the rest of the world for a very long time, that led to the escape of that coronavirus, a close relative of this modern current one, and claimed many lives. This time, again, the same track record of bureaucracy, heel dragging, holding things up. I'm not really clear why a positive antibody test in the face of a negative PCR test, the gold standard that proves a person doesn't have coronavirus infection, should hold up the arrival of the WHO team members, which it did. I mean, a recent study by the Chinese themselves shows that one person in every 20 in Wuhan is currently testing positive on an antibody test for coronavirus antibodies. And therein lies another lie promulgated by the Chinese, because they claimed that the number of people who'd been infected was a fraction of what it really must be based on the estimates from those antibody tests. So they don't really have a strong track record here of cooperation, transparency, data sharing, and openness. And this is what really we need to see. And the WHO have said all along, this is not about finger pointing. This is about the fact that millions of people have died or been infected with this virus. More to come. Britain, 1,500 deaths a day at the moment. The economies of most countries in the world now very heavily into the red. China, the only nation declaring positive economic growth in the last 12 months. And most people are asking, we cannot contemplate the prospect of a repeat of this. We have to make sure we understand how this happened so we can be better prepared to defend ourselves next time. You should cooperate. And I don't see much of that coming back from the Chinese.
I mean, very difficult because we don't know what's been happening, of course, over the last year plus in Wuhan and elsewhere. How optimistic are you that they're going to find something? And we can only assume that they've been this obstructive because there must be some element of track covering going on. But, you know, at this point, okay, of course, we're down the track with vaccines, Chris, and this is all good. But is it important scientifically to get to the actual root cause? Of course, there are many theories around it, obviously. But how key is it? And how key for this mission? Because we've also heard that this WHO team, it's going to be a lot of interviewing and observing and also trying to pave the way to, let's say, to a next more forensic study, which doesn't seem to be what's going to happen this time around.
The way in which you pursue these sorts of things is initially you start with where the cases first started. You talk to as many people as possible and you try to establish patterns of emergence, patterns of spread, patterns of contact, patterns that point to an origin. And once you've got that, you go after how did that origin surface. So included in this should be talking, obviously, to people who were involved right at the start of all of this to try and piece together how it happened and why it happened, or why at least it was detected so early in Wuhan. Because the story doesn't just begin in January of 2020 with Wuhan, because we've now seen data emerge from many other countries where they've got cases, they've got blood samples, they've effectively got proof that the virus was already in their countries in September of last year. So it was obviously ramping up well before then. And we do want to know, when did the Chinese first become aware that this was happening? Because if you remember, the doctor that unfortunately died, who tried to raise awareness, was initially told to shut up and stop being a nuisance by the Chinese police. And he was threatened because he was trying to point out that this does appear to be transmitting between people. The Chinese said, no, it doesn't. But, you know, how long did they really know about this? How long did they actually have samples, and how long were they studying this virus for? Because they gave the genome on the 9th of January to the world. They said, here's the genome of this virus. Well, you don't just discover a virus, prove that it's the cause of something, and then get its genome in 5 minutes. That takes a long time. So how they pieced all this together and managed to do it in such a quick trajectory, unless they'd known about this and were working on it for a really long time, well, that's a mystery to me. But, you know, if on the other hand, there's a perfectly plausible explanation, then they should volunteer it, and they should equally include in the assessment a visit to the Wuhan Institute of Virology to reassure the world that this first-class scientific establishment has no role to play in the outbreak. Because by saying it doesn't and refusing access to investigators or refusing to allow them to properly investigate, it does smack of a cover-up, whether there's a cover-up happening or not. And that's not good for China's reputation.
How much of this is also brand positioning, or let's say sort of brand polishing on the part of the WHO? Because, of course, we've been giving them a little bit of more than a little bit of a hard time because, of course, they seem to have rolled over. Of course, they've said they've not. They're not being compliant with China. They're doing this all on a level playing field. But at the same time, I come back to, you know, is this investigation really important? Because I think a lot of our listeners probably spent a lot of time over the holidays watching lots of political thrillers. And you would think that, of course, there are all kinds of course, security agencies that are also very interested in this, who must have a very good idea. So I guess, how important is this WHO investigation? And then we have to think, are the French or the Germans, are the Americans, you know, much further ahead? And actually, we probably somewhere in a secure bunker, someone's got a very good idea of exactly what happened. And the WHO component of this is just very much not window dressing, but maybe also reputation saving for them as well.
Well, the last time this happened with SARS Mark 1 back in 2002 to 2003, it was an international contingent from the World Health Organization that ran expeditions into parts of rural China and found the natural host of that SARS coronavirus, the first SARS virus that did escape and cause the outbreak around the world. And it was their careful, diligent studies that did that. So these investigations are very important. We do want to know what the origin was, because all we've got at the moment is a coronavirus from bats harvested a number of years ago, actually, that's 96% similar to the one that's circulating in humans. So there's a big missing link there, because to go from that virus to what's circulating in humans at the moment would take 40 years of evolution to happen. So therefore, something is missing. There's a missing link, and we need to find it, whether that's an animal or whether it is some funny, bizarre bizarre thing that's gone on in a laboratory, albeit by accident, potentially. We need to understand this because at the end of the day, history repeats itself unless you learn what's happened and prevent it repeating itself. So these sorts of investigations are very important. They're not just sort of image buffing. They are important because new science can be done and new understandings arrived at, but it does take transparency and it does take cooperation. So we know at the moment we're seeing not much of that from the Chinese based on their obstructive behaviour to date. I hope that they're going to become more cooperative, but I doubt it.
Chris Smith, Monocle's health and science correspondent, joining us there from Cambridge. It's just gone 13:14 here in Zurich. Back over to London, Marcus Hippie is here with today's headlines.
Thanks, Tyler. Donald Trump has become the first president in US history to be impeached twice after being charged with incitement of insurrection. Trump will now face a trial in the US Senate. We'll have more on this story after today's news headlines. The pop star Bobby Wine is challenging one of Africa's longest-serving leaders in Uganda's presidential election. Wine says he represents the country's younger generation, while the 76-year-old incumbent Yoweri Museveni says he stands for security and stability. German media examines the race to succeed Angela Merkel as head of the centre-right CDU party. She has steered Germany and Europe through a series of crises since she took office in 2005, and her replacement will be chosen on Saturday. And Dr. Martens has announced plans for a flotation on the London Stock Exchange. The move could see the shoemaker valued at more than £3 billion, and you can find out much more about it by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Now back to you, Tyler.
Thanks very much, Marcus. We're going to get the very latest now on those political developments in the US that Marcus was just telling us about. I'm joined on the line now by Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent at the Irish Times. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning, Tara.
Let's start. You had to stay pretty late on this side of the Atlantic to get a full read of what's going on. So for our listeners around the world, can you maybe just bring us up to speed as to, of course, also what is now making stories as newspapers are certainly hitting doorsteps. And of course, mm-hmm. all of the U.S. morning shows are fired up now.
Yeah, well, we're waking up here in the United States to headlines that we have seen before. I'm looking at the New York Times in front of me here outside my door this morning with the word impeached. And Donald Trump has made history with the dubious distinction of becoming only the first president to have been impeached for a second time. I was at the session of Congress yesterday covering this impeachment. And really, I suppose the context here is the extreme shock and increasingly anger among lawmakers in Washington about what unfolded last week in the U.S. Capitol when a Trump-supporting mob attacked the Capitol building. And as Democrats see it, Donald Trump specifically incited that mob to do so. As predicted, he was impeached. Democrats always had the vote in the House of Representatives. They always had the numbers to impeach him. But significantly, 10 Republicans joined Democrats to vote to impeach him. Now, in one sense, that doesn't sound like a lot of people, but this contrasts with his first impeachment just a little over a year ago when no Republicans crossed the aisle. And as well as those 10 Republicans, we saw a lot of Republicans who made the argument again and again that they did not want to vote for impeachment because they felt the process was rushed and there wasn't enough time to see evidence, etc. But they strongly criticized Donald Trump's behavior. So I think one of the sub-themes of yesterday was the split within the Republican Party and how deep that split is going to go.
So just tell us, what is the mood in Washington amongst your colleagues in journalism, but of course, being in and around the Capitol as well? We're 1 week on from all of these events that really sort of rocked screens and emotions, not just domestically, but around the world. Has there been a cooling off the longer that we can sort of kick this into next week that maybe not that the issue goes away? But I'm just wondering, what is that sense that you feel there now, or is it ramped up in the other direction?
Well, it's very visceral, actually, because what's happened in Washington over the last few days is that there's been an enormous influx of military personnel to the city. So in the Capitol building yesterday, there were literally thousands of heavily armed guards all around the outside and the inside of the building. I took video and photos on social media of hundreds of guards. You know, some of them were asleep on the ground, checking their phones, waiting for instruction, essentially, to spring into action if needed. And this is a very new sight for journalists and for members of Congress who go in and out of that building all the time. The Capitol is kind of almost like the US Parliament, if you like, supposed to be the people's house. And now there is a huge 7-foot fence erected across around the perimeter. And a lot of people feel, you know, very emotional about this, that it you know, it's cutting off Capitol Hill from its surroundings. It's a very visual reminder in the iconography of the city, really, of what happened last week and the huge security lapse. Of course, a lot of people are welcoming it. They don't want to see a repeat of what happened last week, obviously. And the FBI have been warning that they've been monitoring activity suggesting and threats of another armed attack of some kind in Washington and indeed in the capitals of the 50 states around the country. So people are on edge. The Biden inauguration is less than a week away now. And it was going to be a scaled back event in any event because of COVID. Details are still emerging from the Biden team at the moment. But there's going to be a huge focus on security with up to 20,000 members of the National Guard deployed to the city by next week.
Suzanne Lynch, very, very good speaking to you. Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent for the Irish Times, joining us there from the U.S. Capitol. Now back over to London, Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak is with us. Chris, good afternoon. I wanted to start just with a little bit of detail and focus. Really, next step. So what happens now with the U.S. Senate?
So, Tyler, essentially the Senate will not reconvene in the coming week, despite this, historic impeachment that Suzanne was talking about there. The Senate is likely to actually have an impeachment trial only once Joe Biden takes office. Chuck Schumer, the incoming majority leader from the Democrats, made clear that he will bring a trial as soon as possible after the inauguration. And, you know, there is some reporting this week that as many as 20 Republican senators could be open to impeachment. So it is not entirely out of the realm of possibility that an impeachment trial, you know, that Donald Trump could be convicted. But it will be essentially a quick trial at the start of Joe Biden's inauguration that, of course, or a presidency, I should say, that, of course, presents all kinds of complications, too, because Joe Biden wants to get his own agenda through. He wants to get cabinet nominations approved, and he's going to have to do that against this backdrop. So even Joe Biden himself kind of wants this to be done quickly, send this message, but also at the same time get to the business of running the country.
And just quickly before we go, Chris, what does this mean for family Trump, brand Trump? Do you think that there is any way back from all of this? And of course, we're not just talking about the president himself, but also when we think about the future careers of his daughter, you know, Ivanka, her husband, Jared Kushner. You know, what's your take on that?
Well, Tyler, I think short answer. This is a very divided party now, the Republicans. You know, Donald Trump does have a dwindling number of allies in the White House, where he is currently, and in Congress. It's fair to say, if you will, that the establishment has now very clearly turned against him as a result of what happened last week. But having said that, he still has a base, you know, particularly because many Republicans have been convinced that this election was taken away from them, despite there being no credible evidence of that. You know, about half of Republicans believe that there was essentially nothing wrong with the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Donald Trump himself still has a, you know, approval rating of about 70% among Republicans. So this is going to go on for a long time. There's a chance if Trump is impeached that he will not be allowed to run for office again. But as you say, in terms of who takes on the mantle after that and whether they're really any different in tone and style and policies from Donald Trump, that's still a very open question.
Chris Chermak, our news editor in London, thank you very much for that. It's just 13:22 here in Zurich. We're going away for a very short break. We'll be back right after this. And You are listening to The Briefing with me, Tyler Relay, here in Zurich. We are now off to discuss things related, of course, to the world of retail and luxury. And I'm very happy to say that I'm joined on the line by Alison Stewart Allen. She's from the International Marketing Partners. Alison, good afternoon.
Hello, Tyler. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Very good to speak to you. What are the stories that that popped up on screen from our certainly from our Japanese colleagues this morning? Are these quite remarkable results from the group Fast Retailing, parent of the likes of Uniqlo, which are really reporting rather remarkable results? I'm just wondering, like, I guess first, are you surprised at this time when, of course, we really it seemed that it's often retail, aside from a lot of course, digital and online businesses that are of course, talking about the fact that they're really, you know, up against the wall. So do these numbers from Fast Retailing surprise you?
They do surprise me because of the amazing, you know, growth that this company has had over the last sort of 12 months or so. You know, Fast Retailing, Uniqlo, its stock is up 48% over the past 12 months, which is an incredible increase in its market cap. But then again, it's logical for a couple of key reasons. Number one, it's focused on Asia. So its presence in Japan, Taiwan, China, Vietnam, Singapore. So Southeast Asia has a much better control now of the virus, and consumers are out and about now. They are shopping. They're looking for clothing. They're looking for casual wear. And Uniqlo is perfectly placed to take advantage of this pent-up demand. The challenge they're having, of course, is in markets in the West. But the interesting thing is, you know, this valuation on the back of their success in Southeast Asia puts them on a equal footing in terms of value with the likes of Inditex. So they own Zara and Massimo Dutti and a number of other brands. So, you know, this is a surprise insofar as it's a retailer who's doing extremely well when the majority of their competitors really are not.
And you point to a very interesting area when you say, of course, that in many ways Uniqlo has also been enjoying the fact that their shops are open. It's not just, you know, about sending people to an online experience, but retail has still been buoyant in Bangkok as much as Taipei. This has been important. Now, when we look at the reopening of retail in Europe and North America, when things get back into the groove, what is it going to mean? If I'm a department store, if I'm a mass retailer, as much as I'm a luxury brand, how are we seeing things changing? And do you think people in marketing and shop design departments are pretty busy at the moment thinking when the sun comes out again, it's going to have to feel very different when people return to their high streets and malls as well?
Well, I hope they're thinking that because, you know, you've got to give people a reason to abandon online now. You know, we've had 12 months roughly of conditioning that we can't go to a store, or maybe we can, maybe we can't, depends on the local rules and lockdowns in our respective countries. So we've got to have a very good reason to want to battle, you know, the traffic, public transportation, and get to that physical space, which hopefully is going to be immersive, and I'm going to get to talk to a human. I'm going to learn a lot more about the products and services in store. I will hopefully have some sensory elements, the smell, the fabrics, the textiles, you're going to have to go through a big reinvention to be able to lure customers back into shops. It's not going to be easy, but retailers better be thinking about this now and planning for it so that they sweat this physical asset of a bricks and mortar store.
Alison Stewart Allen. We're going to have to leave it there. That was Alison Stewart Allen, Chief Executive of International Marketing Partners. It's 13:27, going to 13:28 here in Zurich. I'll just let our listeners know we're going to run a little bit over time today as it's a rather busy news day. We'll be back right after this.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Suzanne Schaffert is president of Novartis Oncology. How does the practice of oncology continue to change and advance in the digital age? And what does leadership in this field look like against the backdrop of a global pandemic? Suzanne Sheppard, most of your work focuses on patients with cancer, on treatment plans. What about the risk of a knock-on effect on the diagnostic side? How much of a worry is that to you and your colleagues?
That's really something that really concerns me. And I would even call that the hidden pandemic, because when you saw what happened in that situation of really, it was kind of an emergency for healthcare practitioners, is that the diagnostics were paused. And we know that millions of screenings and diagnostics were just missed. You already saw that probably cancer is advancing more and patients are diagnosed at later stage. And we all know that the earlier you are diagnosed, the better your outcome and the better your prognosis are. I also saw a recent publication in Lancet that is talking about 5-year survival rates for example, breast cancer, colon cancer are expected to go down again. And that's, of course, devastating, because the last really years, we are working hard to make a difference and change the outcome of cancer, really provide more life to patients. And we cannot accept that this is now gone and reversed during the pandemic. So for me, what I felt I can do as someone in industry, we are really interfacing with many, many stakeholders. We are working together with politicians. We are working together with medical experts and physicians. But we are also in dialogue with patient advocacy groups and so on. What I try to do is really amplify the community and raise this topic. I, for example, started a LinkedIn series where I was talking and interviewing experts in cancer in different areas, nurses, medical experts, patients, and see what they advise patients to do and how to navigate the pandemic. So that's only a small piece, but I believe it's very important that in such a phase, we don't drop things and that we make sure cancer care is still at the same level as it was before. And it's also, in a way, what we could do certainly is for patients that are diagnosed and are supposed to receive treatments or are receiving treatments, that we make sure they get them. And in many cases, it's quite easy, but in other cases, it requires injection, it requires monitoring before you start the treatment. And I have to say, my team has really done unbelievable things in record time, for example, getting home monitoring devices ready, working with tech companies to see how can we support patients that they can stay at home, do that monitoring, that the physician will get the data and then start the therapy. So it's quite impressive what a team can do in this kind of circumstances. And I have to say, really, it has accelerated many areas that we were thinking about before.
That's Suzanne Sheppard, president of Novartis Oncology. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with the briefing. 13:32 here in Zurich. Well, meanwhile, back here in Switzerland, the country is taking further lockdown measures from Monday, with restaurants closed till the end of February, a compulsory work from home order, a ban on private gatherings over 5 people, and perhaps most significantly, a wide-ranging retail shutdown that has been met with confusion and anger. While food stores, florists, DIY centers, hairdressers, stationery shops, telecom shops, and cleaning and repair shops can stay open, housewares, fashion, and bookshops must close. With papers saying the modern Swiss way has come to an end and a call for a rethink, some are already doing so. Well, I'm happy to say I'm joined on the line by retailer and journalist Jeroen van Roon from the other side of Zurich. A very, very snowy day here. He couldn't make it into studio. He's with Cabinet. And, first, good afternoon. Very good to speak to you. But you put out a little post this morning. You're going to be taking a slightly different tack. For those of you who don't know Cabinet, a wonderful multi-brand fashion store on the far side of Zurich from where we are. What are you doing to circumvent things, let's say, your own?
Thanks very much, Tyler. It's a difficult situation to close the shop for another 5 to I don't know how many weeks. And it brings me back to where I started from, to my handwork. I was trained originally to be a tailor, and I always thought that one day I might come back to this and use my craft. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to transform our store, or let's say the front section with the window, into a workshop, a tailor workshop, and we are inviting our customers to bring things to be altered or to be repaired, so we can at least make ourselves a bit useful and make a bit of work from it, from this awful situation.
And what does that mean, of course, on the other side of things? Because you've got this fantastic array of wonderful garments, okay, albeit we're into the sale period anyway, because one thing the government is allowing is some version of click and collect. So obviously people can come in with this repair thing. The great thing is that there's going to obviously be things to see beyond. So what happens next? Because this is a bit of a challenge, isn't it? In a way, does someone just have to exit the shop and then call you up and say there's a great cardigan, and then they could just come back in and get it? Is this all part of the sort of this weird gray area retailers are in Switzerland, Jeroen?
Well, it's not a gray area. It's explicit. It is a possibility to keep repair shops open. It is something that is within the law. So we are not doing something illegal. Of course, we keep our online store open, and it is also possible to do click and collect for customers to come by and to pick up what they have ordered online. So that's another reason, because we have to be here anyway. So we make the best of it, and we start working with our hands. And when people come by, they will be able to pick up what they bought online. Mm. But the rest of the assortment, of course, of the collections that are coming in now, we have to keep them away. We have to lock them away, because it's not allowed to sell these in the store, but they will be visible online.
And that brings us to the point of our introduction. It seems there's a lot of frustration across Switzerland today, when, of course, flower stores and many other services, and it's great, of course, that they can stay open, but then people think, well, aren't books also essential? One needs to expand their mind, because we've heard the Florist Association saying, well, yes, of course, flowers make people happy, but someone would also say, well, books are escapism as well. There seems to be, even more than last time, on one side the government wants to try to appease people, but there's a lot of very angry retailers out there now. Of course, you in the fashion business thinking, why are we being penalized? Also off the back of a report out of Princeton saying we don't really see a lot of compelling evidence that if someone goes and tries a sweater on, that we see an uptick in infections.
It is weird. I can't understand it myself. It's we've been working since spring under regulations and restrictions. We're wearing masks all the time. We have plexiglass windows. We limit the amount of people coming into the store, and it has all proved to be kind of a successful way, although it is difficult to work in these circumstances. But now to kind of be forced back into lockdown is really hard to understand, because there is crowds everywhere, but not in our store. It's a bit weird. It's just the wrong way to do it in my eyes, but I can complain, or I can try to make the best of it.
Yes, and I think an amazing reinvention. But I also don't think you are alone. If you look at the papers and certainly the narrative coming out of Switzerland today, a lot of people rather annoyed by these measures. You're a veteran journalist, also retailer, and certainly now a tailor who's rediscovering his roots with Cabinet there. Thank you very much. That's all for today's edition of The Briefing. Our show was produced by Rhys James, Marcus Hippe, and Yolin Goffin. Our studio manager in London, Louis Allen, and here managing the desk in Zurich has been Desiree Bentley. The Briefing is back tomorrow, same time, and I'm going to be back here on Sunday with Monocle on Sunday. I'm Tyler Berlay. Goodbye.